Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Marty Goldenson in for Brian Lehrer. The new health care legislation, the adjustments of which are being signed right now, I understand, by the president, promises to help over 30 million more Americans to afford insurance. Does it mean that New York City's 11 public hospitals are about to enter a new era? And what about the hundreds of community health centers across the state? We're joined by Alvin Aviles, president of the New York City Health and Hospitals Corporation, which oversees the city's public hospitals and clinics, also joined by Elizabeth Swain, CEO of Community Healthcare Association of New York State, an association of over 400 healthcare sites throughout the state. Before we get into, you know, sort of the financial impact, let me just get briefly from both of you the scope and size of the organizations you lead. Alvin Aviles first, 11 public hospitals and also lots of clinics, right?
Yeah, we have about 80 community-based health centers, including six very large, we call them diagnostic and treatment centers that have primary care and specialty care. It's a very large system, 5 million outpatient visits a year.
Right. And Elizabeth Swain?
Hi, yeah, we have 425 service locations across the entire state. And we're providing about 5 million primary care visits in medical, dental, and mental health services across the state of New York through this system.
Right. Let me start with Alvin Aviles, but both of you can chime in on any of these questions naturally, which is this a revolution that we're going to see a lot more people insured over time here, or is this just a modest, slow change?
Well, at the end of the day, 300 million Americans, if that's how many obtain insurance, is a pretty big change. It won't happen overnight.
You mean 30 million, or do you mean that everybody in the country?
30 million is the estimate of the number of presently uninsured Americans who would get insurance coverage under the health care reform legislation, but none of that really kicks in a serious way for 4 years, and then it presumably will ramp up over time. In New York City and for the public hospital system in particular, it's a little bit of a mixed bag. I mean, some of our 450,000 uninsured patients, that's how many uninsured we served last year, will certainly obtain more affordable coverage, but a very large percentage of our uninsured or undocumented immigrants, and they are not covered by national health care reform.
Right, so there's no instant revolution. And what about Elizabeth Swain, who again is CEO of the Community Health Care Association? How does it affect you in the short and long run?
Well, it's a significant, more than significant new law, and it has huge multiple effects on everything from the way we pay for coverage for underserved people to the way this insurance system in the country is designed. But in the immediate first year, and really until 2014, when the when the insurance coverage expansions kick in for the 30 million people that we're talking about, there's not going to be the biggest change will be that there'll be a surge in the demand for primary health care, which is what we're providing in our primary care programs across the state, especially in medically underserved low-income communities. So if you remember what happened in Massachusetts when they implemented a similar law a couple of years ago, overnight nobody could find a primary care provider. Because with this surge in demand, and this is likely to happen before the coverage kicks in, there'll just be a surge in demand for primary care. Nothing in this law's first year is going to do anything to increase the number of primary care providers available to see anybody.
Right, in the short run. There are incentives in the long run, though.
Yeah. I'm talking the first year. I think we're very heartened by the fact that the bill does provide funding for expanding the primary care system across the country. But in the short run, you know, we expect that, you know, like everything else, there are going to be a lot of glitches. And our safety net system is there providing services to people, much like HHC's system, who are completely uninsured or underinsured or what we call underserved
communities. If you're both, you and the Health and Hospitals Corporation, the HHC, are in some ways, you're currently the safety net, both of you, will you be able, do you think, both of you, to be a smaller net because there'll be more people insured? First to Alan Aviles?
Well, at the end of the day, a smaller net, perhaps for the total number of uninsured. Again, in New York City alone, we're talking about an estimated 500,000 undocumented immigrants. So we're going to have a very significant number of residents of our city who remain uninsured. And, of course, our safety net is not just a safety net for the uninsured. 70% of our revenue comes out of the Medicaid program, and we serve hundreds of thousands of Medicaid patients. There's an expansion of Medicaid included as part of health care reform, so those numbers can be expected to go up. And we have every expectation that we will serve some of the other newly insured patients as well in our city.
Are you in the same boat, Elizabeth Swain? Which is to say you don't expect to have to be a smaller safety net.
No, there are two really critical issues. This is not delivery system reform. This is insurance reform. So you've got, you're expanding the number of covered people. In the context of a health system in the city, the state, and the country, that is not going to be dramatically changed by the law, but rather by other things that are happening. As a result of the law, certainly the law is going to create incentives for change, obviously, but it's important to remember that our delivery system and our insurance system are really different, and they've gotten farther and farther apart in the last 30 years. So our delivery system is not ramped up to provide preventive services and primary care services, if you will, the front end. We do much more at the back end of the system where people are already sick, they're seeking care in ERs, they're seeking acute care once they're sick, and we've got a long way to go to build the front end, and we're happy to have this opportunity, don't get me wrong.
Right. I want to dive in and drill down on a couple of those things you raised in just a second. But first, listeners, we'd like to hear from you as well. Doctors, patients, what's your take? Does the healthcare legislation change your plans for the future? Give us a call at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. If you're a doctor there thinking about early retirement, does this maybe postpone it? Does it hasten it? Or leave us a comment at... online at WNYC.org and click on the Brian Lehrer Show. Alvin Aviles, head of the Health and Hospitals Corporation, any chance that you'll have to do less primary care, which is to say basic patient care for somebody, with the flu, at emergency rooms in a few years after this more comprehensive insurance system kicks in?
Well, there will be fiscal challenges that may make it difficult for us to expand primary care capacity, but I certainly think that that is going to be needed. It is fortunate that there is some significant funding in this bill for community health centers, which are such an important source of primary care, particularly in low-income communities, not only across our city, across our state, and across our nation. But that is going to be one of the challenges, as Elizabeth alluded to. Now that you have an insurance card in the hands of so many more individuals, the key is going to be to link them to robust primary and preventive care. That's what will help bring long-term savings to the system.
Could both of you chime in and explain this lack of linkage? You said there's two systems. There's the delivery system and the insurance system. And you were saying, Elizabeth Swain, that they've been growing apart for the last 30 years. It sounds terrible, but it's such an abstract thought, I can't follow it. Explain.
Well, it's 30 or even 40 years ago, we were much closer to a more rational health system where, where was a direct relationship between a doctor getting paid. Think Dr. Welby, and then think, Dr. House. So, 40 years ago,
right. One is completely mentally healthy, and the other is off the deep end, right?
Well, we used to pay for a family medicine model, the family doctor model. The insurance companies, used to reimburse for services that kept people healthy and that and it kept them out of emergency rooms and kept them out of hospitals. And in the last 30 to 40 years, for a whole variety of reasons that have to do with technology, pharmaceuticals, the whole pharmaceutical phenomenon, the mass culture, the obesity epidemic, which nutrition issues, you name it, the housing stock, urban and rural community issues. It's a massive societal shift.
Right.
We now have an insurance industry in this country that's designed to pay much more, is incentivized to pay much more for folks who are in the final stages of their lives, who are very sick, who need a lot of expensive tests. And where's the funding for nutritionists, for asthma educators, for those folks who are relatively inexpensive in keeping people healthy.
By the way, you're listening to The Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. I'm Marty Goldenson sitting in for Brian, and we're talking to Alvin Aviles, president of the Health and Hospitals Corporation, and Elizabeth Swain, CEO of the Community Healthcare Association of New York. Am I wrong that part of this legislation frees communities and local healthcare systems from the existing payment rules and lets them experiment with ways to deliver better care at lower costs?
There are some seeds of experimentation in new payment models in the legislation. So, for example, about $5 million is being appropriated to create a new innovation center at the federal level for that part of the federal government that oversees Medicaid and Medicare services. And the goal of that is to encourage and help fund pilot programs that experiment with delivering care under a different reimbursement model, one that doesn't just reimburse for doing more and more based upon volume and intensity, but one that pays based upon doing evidence-based medicine that improves the outcomes of patients over the long term and does it relatively efficiently and effectively.
Yes. Did you have a reaction to that as well, Elizabeth Swain? You're going to have to gear up for some experiments that will maybe be based on rather than the quantity of care, on the value of it?
Yes. Well, the good news for all of us in this country with the flaw is that it shifts the focus and it creates an incentive for shifting the focus to prevention and primary care as part of the health system, certainly not all of it, obviously. And pilots and experimentations will be things like funding tried and true, an apple a day keeps the doctor away kind of approaches that are really, again, going back to a model of care that we know promotes healthier behaviors, and as well as we've really revolutionized chronic disease management in the last 30 years, and we know now how to manage people who are chronically ill to keep them out of the hospital and to essentially keep them well managed. And the fact that we're now looking to highlight those as they're not experimental any longer. These things have been proven, and there's way more research than we have time to even begin to think about.
Yeah, that's the way. Doesn't government do that often? Which is, you do all these sort of experimental things, you find out that they work, and then they can't get funded, so they fund another experiment. A common pattern, no?
Well, I think the challenge is to figure out how you scale this up and how you actually tie it into the reimbursement incentives that really align what you're trying to achieve with what you're paying for. I mean, we continue to essentially pay a lot more for sick care than we do for health care. I mean, it is driven, the healthcare system is largely driven by those hospital stays and those emergency department visits still. They generate revenue.
Yes.
So the new approach would be, let's make organizations accountable for keeping their patients healthy. And
There's some of that in the new legislation, right?
Well, there again, there is a focus on what are called accountable care organizations, but the challenge is to figure out how do you actually make that a workable model in the real world, and then how do you change the reimbursement system to truly support it. That is, it's a lot easier said than done.
Right. Well, we have a call, by the way, from Bob in Rego Park with a question. Bob?
Hi, how are you today? Great show. I'd like to ask a very profound question. That I live in New York City. I have great health care from HIP, but I have compassion for other people. In the future, when people get their Medicaid cards, whatever the number is, in my experience, I've heard other people, 50% of doctors, you call them up, they don't take Medicare, Medicaid. In New York City, there's specialists making a fortune of money. The regular doctors don't even want to be bothered with patients. So in this new legislation, the president, who I voted for, the main thing he should have done, which he didn't do, that doctors, when that phone call comes, they must see that patient, not say, I don't take Medicare, Medicaid. The whole thing is insanity. How are you going to force doctors to even take these patients?
Well, it does increase, does it not? You know more about this than I do, but it does increase reimbursements at some level, right?
It does, actually. There is a provision in the legislation that will increase the reimbursement for primary care physicians to the Medicare level from the Medicaid level. Typically, Medicare pays more than Medicaid. On a national basis, Medicaid only pays about 72% of what Medicare would pay. So that should help entice more community physicians to serve Medicaid patients.
Right. And will that change things at your local clinics, either of you?
Well, I wanted to just, again, reiterate something that Al referred to, and that is there is a big investment in the expansion of federally qualified health centers, community health centers that are in my network under this law. It's you know, important not to underestimate what that means. There's an investment in this law. A trust fund has been created to double the number of community health centers in the country and increase the number of people served by community health centers by 20 million people in the next 5 years. So that's 20 million people will be served by health centers that aren't currently being served by health centers. Health centers' number one revenue source is Medicaid. So this goes a long way in trying to increase the number of providers, doctors, dentists, nurse practitioners, physician assistants, and all, you know, and social workers who are reimbursed by Medicaid, and goes right to the question that the listener asked.
Yes. Alvin Aviles from the Health and Hospitals Corporation, could that change things, the look of your health centers, both the large hospitals and small clinics?
Well, not unless we do something to convert more of our health centers to a federally qualified health center model, which that's not the model we have. So the dollars that will flow to federally qualified health centers will not come into our system. But it's certainly something that we're looking at as a result of that new funding under the health care reform.
Are you purposely not federally qualified so you can serve all kinds of people?
No, federally qualified health centers do serve everyone. It's a complicated question, but it has something to do with the governance. If you're going to be a federally qualified health center, you need to essentially have an independent board that is controlled by the community that center is serving, and that is not the governance model for the public hospital system. But as I said, we're looking at the possibilities for coming up with a way to maybe move in that direction for our ambulatory care side.
Okay, we go from the complex bureaucratic question to the very basic one from Pat in Valley Stream.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Yes.
I'm, you know, 55. I grew up in a large household of seven or eight people, you know, in my house.
Well, you don't look it, Pat. You don't look 55.
Thank you. I'm so happy in the rain what I look like. Anyway, I was just saying part of the variable that I think we're not talking about is the number of people that have to go to the doctor will change, because if you're going to these health community centers, you're going to have to wait forever to see a doctor. And secondly, the people that need to go for preventative care have not been going. That's why we see all these very, very sick people showing up, because they wait until the last minute to go to the doctor. So the variable of who's going to show up at the doctor is you're forcing people to have this health care, and you're forcing them to make a decision to go see the doctor when, in fact, they've already made up their mind they don't want to go see the doctor, even with an illness. They want to manage it on their own.
I get it. Elizabeth Swain, who is CEO of the Community Healthcare Association of the state of New York, is that a mischaracterization of people who come to your clinic or why they would stay away? Are there long lines? Is it expensive to get preventive care, et cetera?
Well, our federally qualified health centers are health centers which are run a lot like private doctor's offices, and you have to have an appointment to go. So there may be long lines. There may be long queues to get appointments. And what I said earlier in the show, which the listener may have missed, is that we anticipate that that's going to be one of the first big issues and big problems, is that we don't have the primary care and preventive care delivery system in place to respond to an increased number of people who are going to come in. All the research indicates that, yes, once you have insurance, you're much more likely to seek care for prevention and primary care than you would if you were uninsured. So we're expecting, we've already seen an increased demand for services, and we're expecting to see that get worse. I mean, of course, we're in a recession as well, which has an impact. But even in times, even when times are better, we simply do not have an adequate primary care system in place. In spite of the 5 million visits that we're providing across the state and the 5 million visits that HHC is providing in the city. So it's a big, that's the number one problem.
We're going to have to leave it there, but thanks so much. Alan Aviles, who is president of New York City's Health and Hospitals Corporation, and Elizabeth Swain, who is CEO of the Community Healthcare Association of the State of New York. Thanks, both of you, for joining me.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC Radio. I'm Marty Goldenson, in for Brian. Coming up next, an attorney and then a career coach join us to talk about how to combat ageism in the workplace.